Hi, my name is Carl Olson, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of the 16x9 Cinema Digital Convergence Podcast. Today, we have a special treat. We have two guests on at the same time. A couple of guys I just recently found out about, saw some of their work on Vimeo, and also been following their blogs and their websites. And I really, really like their work. And I think if you go out, I'll provide some links so you guys can go out and look at it. Really, really nice stuff. And they also had the privilege of being interns with Philip Bloom. And as you will recall, he was on a recent podcast here, and he talked very, very highly of these two fine cinematographers here. So I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to introduce you to them. I have with us Nino Leitner, right?
Leitner, yes.
Leitner, okay. And Sebastian... Hold it. Now, let me try this, okay? Let me try it.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Weigartner, right?
Wrong. Weigartner.
Weigartner.
Yeah.
Weigartner.
It's a special name.
Well, see, okay, so the I and the E, yeah, the I comes before the E, so it's we. If E becomes before I, it's...
Just ignore right. the
just call me Weigartner.
Can I just
imagine there are just two E's and you pronounce it right.
There you go. Okay. Well, can I just call you Sebastian?
Yeah.
Okay. Sebastian, you know the English tongue is spoiled because I guess we were a melting pot here in the States, and so all the languages came together and our tongues just chose whatever was the easiest thing to. I don't know. We're just not very good with language. But we try. I'm trying.
My English is not good. Too. No problem.
Well, see, English is the only language I know, and I have trouble with it, too. So, well, I'm glad to have you guys here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Great to be here, yeah.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Sebastian. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about background?
Yeah, of course. Okay. I'm Sebastian. I'm from Germany. I live in Bavaria. This is near where every year the Oktoberfest is celebrating.
That's done here in the state of Georgia.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's in Las Vegas too. Yeah, and I live in near Bamberg and Nürnberg, between Bamberg and Nürnberg and Forchheim. Right. And I started to make filming last year. I bought a Canon 70. I saw it on Philips' website.
Right.
I just wanted to buy a Sony X3 with a Lettuce 35mm adapter.
Sure.
But it costs too much. And then I saw the Canon 7D, bought one, and made my first film. And this was an image film for a wallpaper factory, and it was such a success. Overnight, I had many, many views. And 5 months later, I was on Lucasfilm set with Philip Bloom. It's amazing.
That's a real shortcut you took there.
And we'll come back to that. That's great. And we'll talk about that film a little bit, too, because I was watching it again. I watched it several months ago when it first came out. And then I watched it again this morning. And I just – well, actually, what set that off is I saw this incredible video from DuPont. I think it was old corporate video from 1952.
Yeah, so, I saw it too again. What today?
Yeah,
yeah. You mm-hmm. Sent a link on Twitter.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And I saw it. Yeah,
yeah. But then that got me to thinking about corporate films and what's being done today and how they're contrasted, and immediately thought of your movie there. So very nicely done.
Yeah, thank you,
Nino. About you?
Yeah. Well, I live in Vienna, but I am originally from the western part of our little tiny country, Austria.
Yeah.
I'm from Innsbruck, which is considered the heart of the Alps. You know, it's a 150,000 people town, which is right in the middle of these beautiful mountains.
Right.
So I was really exposed to lots of nature in my childhood.
Great.
And yeah, of course, because you take 10 minutes and then you are up on the mountain and can go snowboarding or skiing. So it's really, really 10 minutes is an exaggeration, but maybe half an hour. So
right, yeah.
And yeah, my parents have an advertising agency in Innsbruck. And I've always wanted to when I was a child to be a part of it, actually. But then I discovered my love for film when I was in high school, and I started studying film in Salzburg, which is, you know, Mozart town,
right,
the
yeah.
famous where he is from. And and I graduated 4 years ago. I spent half a year during that studies in England in my exchange semester. And then I moved to Vienna because this is where the film industry is in Austria. And here I am.
Great. Yeah.
And well, yeah.
So you came from a creative background. I assume with your parents being in advertising, there's creativity flowing in your blood there.
I guess so, yeah. But my real, I discovered my parents, I think, always wanted me to take over the business someday. But I think this is what my brother's doing now, so that's fine.
That's good.
That's
what brothers are for.
Yeah, exactly. But I still work a lot with them and also their clients, and I help
right.
them doing films, and we get a lot of cooperation going. Yeah.
Well, I was watching a couple of your films this morning as well. The first one I saw yesterday was the where you were on the crane in Innsbruck.
Oh, yeah.
I really like that. And I watched it again this morning because it's such a unique point of view that...
It is.
Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, actually, it was really just basically a test because I talked to a client which is not even... yet a client, just a prospective client, a construction company, and they want to do an image film because they have a anniversary coming up, and the boss of the company just said if I could just go up that crane because they will dismantle it 2 days later, so I should do that right now even before they decide if they want a whole image film.
Right.
And so yeah, that's what I did. I just was there at the meeting, and then I went to get my camera and went up the crane, and basically was really struck with this perspective because it's, as you said, it's something you really usually don't have a chance to. You know, this perspective is really unique. You can't get it with a helicopter. You can't, film out of a building. It's just the only way to do it is out of a crane because you can go so close to other buildings. And it was quite exciting. But I was happy to have my camera with me. Otherwise, I would have gotten some vertigo, I guess.
So you didn't actually ride on the crane with it, but the camera was mounted on the crane?
No. I was
oh, you
in,
were
a,
on the
in
crane.
A cage. Yeah, I was.
Yeah,
but
okay.
I just focused on filming, you know. I didn't.
So
I didn't
your eyes were open.
Exactly. But on the screen, you know, I hid behind the camera.
How high was the crane?
Well, it's around, I think 100. Is it 100 meters? Something like that?
So that'd be roughly a little over 300 feet.
300 feet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know exactly, but I have a photo on my blog of the crane. If you go on my blog, I took a photo before I went up there. It's quite high. It's, you know, the really big construction cranes you see on construction sites every day. Yeah.
Well, I think I commented on your on the Vimeo site. It's like being in a jetpack.
Oh yeah.
I think, well, if I could fly in a jetpack, that's probably the view that I would have. But it reminds me too of one of our previous guests. His name is Art Howard. He's an Emmy Award winning cinematographer. He's worked for National Geographic, Discovery, and Discovery Channel, and other television projects like that. And one of the things he brought out was you need to show the audience something that they don't expect or something that they wouldn't normally see. And so that's what struck me about this particular film was it was a different point of view.
Yeah.
And then the second point that you brought up is you just had your camera with you.
I didn't have any
lesson.
Stabilization. I mean, I had the tripod, but when I was up in the cage, I realized I can't use it because there is there are metal bars on the side of the cage. So I just had to hold it out of this window, basically, and I just took the strap around my neck and pulled it away from me to get some stabilization, and then we just moved the crane. You know, the operator was right next to me, and he had the remote control, so he could turn the thing 360 degrees up and down everywhere we wanted. So that was quite cool.
Did he let you play with the controls too?
No.
Oh, man.
I didn't have, you know, my hands were on the camera. How should I tell?
Well, I don't know. It's a machine. Well, Sebastian, I'd like to get back to you. You'd mentioned the film that you did.
For the wallpaper.
Yeah. What was the name of the company?
It's Hornberger Wall Coverings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful film. How did that come about?
Yeah, it was last year, and they wanted to have a film for a fair trade. And the shooting, I went there one day, and the shoot was only one day. And I cut it in 2 days with Final Cut and Magic Bullet Looks. And yeah, then I sent it to the customer and uploaded it to Vimeo. There was no correction of the customer. They wanted to have it this way. And yes, they have many, many success with this film.
It's a very poetic film. And it's, yeah. I mean, you show a close-up of the gears and the machinery and the people.
Yeah, old machines. It's not a very beautiful place.
But you made it beautiful.
Yeah, when you saw something what is not so beautiful, you have to do some close-ups.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the job. And with the close-ups and with the glide track system, you can make really, really, really stunning films. And
go
ahead, Nino. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say that's one of the advantages of these new DSLR cameras with the fast lens. You can get everything out of focus except for a little tiny bit. Stay in focus, and that will look so nice to our eyes. But even, I mean, just filming a portrait is so much nicer with these cameras. Compared to your usual, you know, even €10,000 HD TV camera. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's difficult too when you shoot with an open lens.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. So I set the lens to 2.8 when I shoot some portraits or some people who are moving.
Right.
Because it's nearly impossible to focus when you have an open lens. With these DSLRs.
Right, yeah. Well, did you have video experience prior to doing this?
No. This was really...
No, wait a minute, wait a minute. Say that again. You had no video experience before you shot this film?
No. This was my, really, really my first movie. Or
you know
film,
what?
Short film, commercial film. Yeah, my first film.
I quit. I just quit. Why should I even try, man? It's a fantastic film, and that was your first. That's incredible.
Yeah, I made a little short film here of my daughter.
Yeah.
But this film was my first commercial work, and it was my second film with a DSLR. But I filmed never before.
Right. Well, how did you? I mean, everything's perfectly composed, and the editing is superb on this. So, how did you learn that?
Yeah, it's learning by doing. Mm-hmm. I am CEO of an advertisement agency.
Right.
And I make websites, corporate designs, and things like that. That I have Photoshop and this software, and then you know a little bit of this color correction and things like that, and then it is easier to do such a film when you can't when you don't have this experience. With my background, I have on because of my advertisement agency,
right.
I can't do it.
Yeah,
I couldn't do that film. I think
so. You developed an eye. And that's
learning by doing.
Right. Well, that's the best way.
Yeah,
get out there and do something. So and both.
Yeah.
You
after
have...
after school, I was self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
And,
hey,
and
me,
let's go,
me too.
and let's go and do it.
Yeah.
So you both had an entrepreneurial—I can't even say that word. You both had a spirit for doing business.
Oh, I don't know. It's really hard.
Yeah, it is hard, but I guess that's why Sebastian and me really clicked when we met the first time on the set with Philip, because we just get along nicely. I think we had a great time there.
That's yeah. great.
I was really happy that I wasn't the only intern there.
Maybe that's
and
what I'm going
to do. And we had one apartment.
Oh, no.
We had to get friends, because otherwise we would have killed each other.
Neither one of you snores, right? Yeah. No comment on that.
You know, we didn't have a lot of sleep, so I guess we just fell in our beds and just went dead for 5 hours and then got back up again. So
you guys had never met before.
No.
And so let's back up and tell us the story. How did you get involved with Philip Bloom and this project with Red Tails?
He looked for an intern on Twitter, and I sent him a mail, only one sentence. And a few weeks later, he sent me a mail and do you want to come to Prague? And I said yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Similar with me, but I sent him more sentences, I guess. But just I guess he didn't read them. But yeah,
my English is not so good.
standard application procedure thing.
Yeah. Well, that's neat. Well, when I talked to him, he did mention seeing your work. So, and it's not a decision that he made lightly, choosing who was going to work with him. So it's quite an honor that both of you had a chance to work on that project. Yeah. So, well, what was it like? What was your job?
It was great. I mean, we can't talk too much about what happened on set, because it's all really secret and big Hollywood movie and stuff. But
you mean I can't get the scoop here?
No,
I can't. I need to take you to a bar, give you some beer. No, that's the iPhone story with Gizmodo, isn't it? No, that's fine.
And you won't get the 5D Mark III from me.
Oh,
I won't forget it.
You've got the 5D Mark III?
Of course, no.
Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah, where were we?
You were going to tell us all about Red Tails.
You were going to tell us
about the experience. Yeah.
Yeah. I was following Philip online for a really long time. I think almost for 2 years before he got into DSLR filmmaking. Yeah. He was the original person who got me into the Sony XDCam EX3, which I bought, which is a larger camera. And when he was still considered the master of 35mm adapters, but I never really wanted to buy them. So, but I was like everybody online, I was in contact with him sometimes. And then when he got into DSLR filmmaking, I realized, okay, this is the next step. And I waited for a really long time to get into DSLR filmmaking. So at some point, I was lucky enough to test the 550D, which is a whole other story. But my contact with Philip, like many others, I got a lot of questions about these cameras and got more into contact with him. And then I applied for this job, and he, after some weeks, said he has me and Sebastian as interns, and he wants us to do second camera assistant.
Great.
But in the end, we are safe to say that we did mostly behind the scenes shoots on set, because. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, that's what I wanted to add. In all seriousness, I don't want you to go break any NDAs or anything like that. So, and I appreciate that. Otherwise, they will never find us again. We'll be in some landfill somewhere.
Yes.
So,
absolutely.
But what does it mean when you work with Philip? Exactly, what did it mean? What was your job as interns to work with him?
Well, as I said, originally the plan was to do second camera assistance, but I think I'm not sure if Philip realized that before, but I think he didn't, that Lucasfilm actually got a second camera assistant for him. So we basically decided to be his additional assistants, of course, but we were usually not always working with him right mm-hmm. on the camera, you know, like sure. changing lenses and stuff. We assisted Philip Bloom on set with different stuff. We brought him coffee. Another great thing was we really had, I'd say, enough space on set yeah. to with all the waiting time involved in every movie shooting. You know, this is really normal. You have a lot of time to learn a lot of stuff from other people, sure. and especially from Philip in this case. So we were able to talk with him about all kinds of stuff. I mean, he just gave us complete trust with all his gear, so we were free to take whatever we wanted of his lenses or cameras, which he didn't use on set. The other ones he used, of course, we didn't have access to, but right. everything he didn't need, we could just use on set for our behind the scenes shoots. So right. this was really great. Yeah.
Now, not everyone that's listening to this is going to know what a second unit or second camera.
He was. You mean Philip's job on,
yeah.
on set?
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah, he's doing. I mean, there's a main camera which is doing all the most important mm-hmm. shots, actually, and most important angles of the shots.
Right.
And then Philip went in, and this is what he posted on his blogs mm-hmm. about the Lucasfilm story as well. They are interested in having an additional perspective. Shots with a smaller camera,
right.
which is in this case the 70, because it mounts PL lenses, which they want to use on set mainly.
Right.
So that's why they don't use the 5D.
Yeah.
They want to have angles which they can't get with the real big cameras. So he usually, as Philip stated on his blog, I think his job was to. When a set is done and the shots are really fixed, the shots of the main cameras, he just goes right in and tries to find another interesting angle. So the cool thing about this whole thing is that the DSLR unit, as he calls it, is really quite free in what they're doing on set, as opposed to some of the other parts of a big production. So he really could suggest to the producers angles which he liked and additional perspectives on the stuff that was being shot. Yeah,
great. Sebastian, what would you say was one of the most important lessons that you learned during this project?
Wow, that's a really, really good question. What I learned? Yeah, I saw everything. What is going on a film set?
Yeah.
And that was a really, really good, experience. Mm-hmm. And I will shoot some short films this summer. Mm-hmm. And now I know what to do and what is. The job of somebody on the second unit, first unit, as second AC, first AC, and that was my experience. I know how a film is shot.
Great.
That was my experience on set, and I didn't know how a film. How a film is produced before, and now I know it, and it was a really, really great experience on set of Lucasfilm. I know this is the best film set in Hollywood, I think. Yeah. And I made an image film 5 months before, yeah. and now I'm here.
Well,
it's incredible.
I think this isn't this an exciting time to be taking up the craft of filmmaking.
Yeah, it's really exciting. You have Twitter, you have a weblog, you have Vimeo, and you have a Canon 70, 5D, or 1D, and you can make stunning films in a quality you can't do it. You couldn't do it before.
No,
you couldn't do it before at a low price, and everyone with talent and the eye can do it now, and that's amazing.
Well, that was one of the points that Gail Tattersall made when I had a conversation with him in a previous podcast, was he felt that this camera was giving people an unprecedented opportunity to produce great art that wasn't available to them before.
Yeah,
it's really democratizing the whole process of filmmaking.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you probably know this Facebook group. my mom bought me a Red, and now I'm a DP. which is really, I mean, it really sums it up, basically. Because I know lots of people, really, from the industry, in from everywhere, actually, that think that great equipment will make great films, which is absolutely not true, of course. But they usually think, you know, I have to save up to 20,000 euros and I buy a Red camera, and then I'm the great DP because everybody's going to book me. I mean, big news is the gear isn't doing it, you know. That's not the main thing of differentiation. I mean, everybody can rent a Red for 150 euros a day. So why even bother without lenses? Yeah. But I mean, with these cameras, you can really have, for the first time, a really comparatively of quality and an image that can be compared to some of the large film and professional. Bigger video in brackets, in quotation marks, video cameras, because they also produce a filmic, cinematic image. But this wasn't, as Sebastian said, wasn't possible only a few years ago. I mean, when I was still studying, we were so happy when the Panasonic DVX-100 came out, which was the first mini DV camera to have progressive frames. I mean, this is only, I think that was six, seven years ago, or maybe
it hasn't been that long. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was really a revolution back then. But if you compare it, if I look at images, it's still a great camera. I still have it. I won't give it away because it's the best backup camera you could ever have, you know. It doesn't break or anything, but still, I mean, you can't compare the images. It's a whole different story. And especially then first HD came up with its super sharp images, which were actually too sharp in many cases, and you still had to use lots of additional gear, like these really bulky 35 millimeter adapters to get great cinematic look. And now you have a camera which is basically just, you know, yeah, fits in your pocket, and you have a cinematic tool with you all the time,
right,
which is incredible.
And that gets right back to the point that you made earlier. You had the camera with you when you had that opportunity to get that shot on the crane. I mean, that's how many people do that. And that was with the 550D, right?
Right.
Yeah. Sebastian, what how do you handle your post-production work? What software do you use? And just tell them a little bit about that process there.
Yeah, no problem. I have an iMac, really, really old iMac. It's an Intel Core to Duo, 2 gigahertz and 4 gigabyte RAM, and Final Cut Pro. I have MPEG Stream Clip to convert my files directly from my CF card.
Right.
And I have Magic Bullet Looks. And it's a really, really, really great tool to make some color corrections and to get some more cinematic feeling. And these tools are incredible. And these are the only tools I use to make my films. And you don't need so much. You don't need so much. You don't need the fastest computer. You don't need Avid or other program software. You can use Final Cut. You can use Magic Bullet Looks. And there you go. It's incredible.
Yeah, the grading, color grading has been highly simplified, that's for sure. You know, how about you?
Well, I use a similar setup with a Mac Pro 8 core. And because I usually have to go through, I also shoot on bigger cameras with higher data rates, like the rented ones, and also I just finished 2 months ago a commercial which was shot on Red, and we tried to maintain the high quality workflow throughout the whole production. So I graded it in, I didn't grade it in the Red Code codec, but with ProRes 4444.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, it's really demanding for the computer and also the color correction. But to color correct, I usually use Apple Color, which I really got into with this image project, because it's, I mean, Magic Bullet is great with all the presets and what you can change and stuff like that, but it's more of a grading software than a color correction software to me. So if you really want to do the correction, you know, like match every shot and get the same look on every shot, it's much more accurate with color, of course. But in the end, it's always nice to give some gloss over the images. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to put it. So you color is the nuts and bolts of applying the paint.
Yeah.
And then Magic Bullet is the shellac shell over it.
Or, exactly. But yeah. You can get the same effects. You know, if you, yeah. you have to build your presets yourself, basically.
Yeah.
But you can do the same stuff as in Magic Bullet, or almost the same with color. And that's what I usually do.
Sebastian, yeah. did you work in color at all?
Yeah, one time.
And that was all it took, huh?
I only use it one time, but I will use it in future.
Yeah.
But Magic Bullet looks it's really fast and it's easy, and you can make your own presets. You don't need to use the presets from Magic Bullet looks. You can do it your
right.
own one.
Yeah.
And I normally do that. I don't use the presets from Magic Bullet. I make my presets myself.
Great.
And it's really a great software. And everybody on a MacBook or MacBook Pro can do it.
Well, I think that's...
you don't need a Mac Pro with 8-core or things like that. You can use a.
I do.
He does because he's using
you
red.
You can use a normal MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
And start grading, and you get a really, really cinematic picture. And
yeah, actually, that's true. I mean, for editing, even my old, really old white MacBook is still enough. I mean, yeah. mm-hmm. I edit on the 4-year-old MacBooks from time to time when I'm on the road, because I just refuse to shell out some thousand euros for a MacBook Pro that doesn't have a express card slot anymore. Which,
well, you know,
I
was just reading a article, I think it was yesterday, but that was one of the things they were talking about Apple products is just the longevity of the product. It just keeps going and going and
yeah.
going. Whereas, and I'm not trying to start a OS war here, but I worked as a Windows developer for many, many, many years, and we always considered Windows rotting from the first day you booted it up, brand new. But I, you know, when I switched to the Mac, the Mac I have is 3 years old, and it feels just as good today as it did then.
Yeah,
in performance. So,
well, the advantage also is, you know, when you sell that stuff, you get more money. And it's more expensive, of course, but if you sell a Mac after 2 or 3 years, you still get it. Quite a bit of money, and
yeah,
with a Windows
correct.
Machine, it's just not possible. Although, I mean, if you see it neutrally, it's stupid because it's the same hardware. It just refused to let their OS run on every machine. But still, that's the way it is.
Yeah, I that is so true. Like I said, I don't want to start an OS war.
Yeah,
I just
let's change the subject. But I think we're all on Mac, and I've been on Mac since I was 12, so I haven't ever used really Windows except when I have to. But
me too.
Well, see, with me, it was just, I mean, I had to work in Windows for years, and I didn't really seriously consider the Mac, but until about 3 years ago, I went to, there's a Apple store here in Atlanta, Georgia, and a friend of mine, and who was also a subcontractor working for me at the time, he says, I need to go into this store. I said, okay. And so we go into an Apple store, and it's the first time I had ever seen an Apple store. It was unbelievable. It was jammed, packed with people. And this was on a weekday.
Yeah.
I went home that afternoon. I sold all my Microsoft stock and bought Apple.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I just, because the Microsoft stock had sat still for years. So,
well, I have to tell you, when I was in England in my exchange semester in 2004, yeah. This is a confession, actually.
Okay.
I went to the first Apple store opening in Europe, which was the Regent Street Apple store, which is still there, Europe headquarters. And I lined up with all those crazy people at 4 in the morning, I think, just to get
Stood in line.
Yeah, I stood in line, but only for 3 hours or so. But still, I wanted to get the gift bag, you know. It just gave away some MacBooks and stuff. I didn't get it. I got a free T-shirt. Woohoo!
Well, that's good. Well, you see, I since we've turned this into a confession show, I don't know where Jerry Springer is right now, but I stood in line, too. I didn't intend to. I went to the Apple store when the iPhone came out. Mm-hmm. And I had no intentions to stand in line. I was just going to see if it was within reach, and the line looked okay, so I said, "Oh, okay, I'll give it a try." The next thing I know, I'm in that line for what, 5, 6, 7 hours. but see, crazy. Yeah, well, you get to a point where you say, "All right, I've already invested this much of my life, which I will never get back. Do I abandon this mission now
that
or not?"
That is true. That's the exact same thought I had. Yeah. But actually, I met some really cool people there. I mean, not all of them are total geeks. Some of them are really fun to be around. Yeah, and I'm actually still in contact with one of them.
Oh, well, see, I've turned this show into the Mac
hardware and software.
Yeah, we got to stop that. Get back off the geek stuff. Okay. But you know what? Those tools, I guess what we're talking about here with tools, has really made it easier for us to sit down and not be fiddly with this stuff and just be able to produce great art. And I think that's evident with what you've done, Sebastian, with your work, and you too, Nino, is just able to sit down and create beautiful art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, also for me as a documentary filmmaker, it's the great thing about these cameras is that they are so unobtrusive. I mean, you can, when I think back, when I was in England, I did this, I did a 1 hour, which was my diploma film, a 1 hour documentary on video surveillance in Britain, which is, if you've ever been there, you know they are everywhere. They have CCTV cameras on toilets sometimes. I mean, it's crazy. You have every corner of every corner of every British city, especially London, of course, is covered with dozens of cameras. I mean, if you look around on the street, it's crazy. And that's what the starting point was for us to start this documentary. But we really had problems getting permissions, of course, to film in some of those really highly restrictive areas. And then I was shooting that with the DVX-100, and that was difficult. I mean, this camera is relatively small, but compared to a DSLR, it's still big. So today it would be much easier to sneak into some police station and do some covered interviews or something like that, which was just not possible with the equipment only, you know, five or four years ago.
Now, Sebastian, I saw that you had done a PL mount conversion.
Yeah, from Denz.
It's
a company from Munich, and they modified the Canon 7D with a PL mount, and they worked they are working for the film industry in Munich, and there is a company called Arri. Everybody knows Arri,
right?
Mm-hmm. And they are in Munich too, and they modified now the Canon 1D Mark IV and the Canon 5D Mark II. With a PL mount, and yeah, you can buy it now, and it's a really, really great quality. I saw a Canon 7D with PL mount on set of Lucasfilm Retails, and it's nearly the same quality.
Well, let me back up just a little bit, Sebastian. Not everyone's going to know what a PL mount is or why you would be interested in that. Would you mind taking a moment just to explain what a PL mount does and why you would do it?
Yeah, of course. A PL mount is a mount where you can put on lenses which were used on big cinema cameras. And there you can mount Arri lenses and Zeiss lenses. And they have a Panavision mount too, mm-hmm. Dense. Okay. And there you can put on Panavision lenses on the Dense Canon 7D, 5D, and 1D.
And why would people want to use those lenses as opposed to the stock Canon lenses?
Yeah, I think when you are a private guy and you shoot some films because it's your hobby,
right.
You shouldn't buy this camera.
Yeah.
But when you are in the film business or camera rental or things like that,
yeah.
You can buy it because on a film set or for broadcast or things for professionals, you can buy one and use ARRI lenses
mm-hmm.
when you use the Canon 7D PL mount
right.
as a B-cam. You can use the same lenses of the A-cam, and that's great.
Yeah,
you have the same settings, and you can see it too.
I think it's also important,
but not on internet. You can't see it in the internet when you watch a film with PL mount on Vimeo. I don't think you see a difference between.
I think that depends on the lens because they have really. Well, now we used to talk about finally getting shallow depth of field. Now that we have it, we can talk about the different kinds of depth of field that are out there. The so-called bokeh,
right.
And really different lenses have different looks. I used one of Philips. Philip has a really great size. Prime lens with I think 85mm 1.4 which is a really nice bokeh. It really looks very, very filmic. And even I talked to Rick McCollum on set about that lens because he really likes it too. So that's really different between the lenses. But I also think it's important for professionals to have these PL mount lenses on the DSLRs because of the focus pulling. Because the problem with these Canon lenses is this small shift you have to take just to move the barrel just a tiny bit and you're completely out of focus because they are photo lenses essentially.
Yeah, and it's not a linear pull either.
And they also don't have stops.
They have no stops on focus, and these cinema lenses have some hard stops, and this is great for some professionals. But if you are a private guy and make some films with your Canon DSLR, you don't need it.
I think it's really, really tough. I mean, to pull focus with the Canon lenses, that's why everybody wants to have HDMI out with full resolution to be able to plug in a monitor to get the full resolution HD to help you focus essentially, because it's even with all the accessories of viewfinders you can stick on these cameras, it's still really tough to tell, especially with the 5D, if you are in focus or not. I mean, it's really magnifying pixels as well. So
right, yeah,
yeah.
All right. Have both of you rigged up your camera with follow focus and rails and matte boxes and things like that?
Yeah, of course. But we used the Sakuto one in Prague.
Yeah,
and it's really portable and it's point and shoot, and this is incredible when you have another rig, a big rig. I have an Indian one, and this is really, really heavy and bad quality.
Yeah.
And when you use one from Sakuto, and there are another companies too, which are selling these products, it's a different world. Don't save money in the first time. Spend a little bit more money, and then you get a really good stuff because you have to buy. You have to pay the second time more.
Right, it'll be a false economy.
Yeah, I think I have to say I really was a bit, confused about the high pricing of some of the manufacturers. Also Sakuto before I used them. But then now that I know how, this rapid fire works and how great it is to have this really light setup, which is totally versatile, I think it's really worth it. And I think I'll get one soon. But even, I mean, the pricing is a bit insane still. But if you think about it, as Sebastian said, it really pays off because you're just going to have it forever. And I think they even offer, you know, lifetime warranty. So,
yeah. Well, to me, one of the biggest challenges, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, but it's just transitioning from still photography to motion. And so what I started off doing was just plopping the camera on the fluid head, but that frustrated me because I really wanted to move around, but I didn't feel confident hand-holding the camera. So motion, introducing motion into to video is I think, an important part of
it.
Yeah.
That's one of the mistakes that many photographers that come into filmmaking do at the first time, that they just film, you know, static shots, but you usually have to try and get some motion in the frame just to, you know, make use of it.
Yeah. Great. Do you guys, do you get into profiling your cameras and adjusting the looks and picture looks and things like that prior to shooting with your video?
Yeah. Of course. I use the flat picture profile.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to get the full color, Nino, describe, you know what I mean?
The full color range, you know.
Yeah.
We both use you know, Stu Marshwitz profile. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses it. I mean, I think Philip popularized it, and everybody uses it now. And this is really giving you, I think, two stops more in post-production to grade your images then.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Well, what kind of future projects do you guys have lined up? Maybe we'll start with Sebastian on that one.
Okay, wonderful. I will shoot a documentary for broadcast in the next month. And it will be the first DSLR production in television in Germany, Switzerland, and Austria.
Wow.
And this will be really, really incredible. And the producer of this documentary, so my image film, my world covering image film on Vimeo. And yeah, he sent me a message. And then he booked me to be to make the camera with DSLRs for this documentary for a broadcast channel.
So he found you on Vimeo, and that's how he
found
you.
Yeah. He watched my film, my image film about the wallpaper factory, and then he contacted me a few months ago, and now I will be DP of this documentary with DSLRs.
What's the subject matter, or is that something you can talk about?
I can't speak about.
You'll keep us posted as it develops. Then,
yeah,
that'll be great. Well, we look forward to hearing your experiences on that.
Yeah, we'll publish some. I will post it on Twitter, and but I can't talk about it in detail.
Sure. Yeah.
But I will post things I can speak about.
Yeah, I always hate asking that question. Well, part of me hates it, and the other part, my curiosity gets the better of me. So. But I totally understand. I mean, I have to do the same thing. There's a lot of things that I can't show, and I wished I could. But anyway, but now you did something that was very interesting, and this is something that Rodney Charter said. You know, basically, he was really down on film schools, and he said the best thing a person could do is to, if he could give advice today, would be to invest in the demo reel. And Vimeo makes that possible. And that's what you did. You put a great film up there, and somebody found it.
Yeah, and I use social media extremely. Yeah. Sure. I use social media.
No.
I send it to Philip and another guys who are big in this business, and they commented on it, and they liked it, and they have many contacts on Vimeo too, which subscribed to their content and to their likes. And then that was the point. No? That was the point. It was that it was such a successful film.
Yeah, well, great. Congratulations. Nino, what about you? What's your future plans?
My future plans? Yeah.
Projects. Maybe there is a slight difference there. Yeah.
Might be, yeah. My projects, yeah, I have some bigger two or three image films lined up, which are waiting to be shot actually in summer. And I'm also preparing a new documentary, which I do myself. I direct it, and right. I probably will do part of DP on it. But I also can't really talk about it because it's still in the development phase. And now with,
I have stuck out three times today.
I just had to apply for all the funding and stuff. And until I get some feedback on that, I can't really comment on the content, so this is quite boring for me.
Boy, you guys are like talking to politicians. No comment.
But you can ask me something about some past projects I can talk about.
Okay. Yep. Are there any past projects we can talk about? No.
You know, like Sebastian just talked about his image film, which was such a success. I also was really, I mean, I've been doing films for almost 10 years now. Right. And only now that I mean, I had this documentary I talked about, which was quite a success because it's on DVD and available on everywhere, actually. But I went to lots of film festivals with it, which was, I didn't succeed in selling it to big TV companies or something. Only one broadcaster in Canada just will show it next month or so, and some in Austria. But the great thing about the film was to get all these contacts and to be able to meet people from all over the world and plan new projects with them, because I went from Brazil to California to London, right. and it even was in Australia, but I wasn't there. So this is really exciting to produce. You know, even if it's just, I can just recommend that to people. If you're doing a short film or something, just send it to all those festivals you can think of. Because
that's a good point. Yeah,
it really really pays off if you are really have the time and patience to wait for all the answers. And I also can say it really usually doesn't pay off to send it into those festivals who charge a whole lot of money just to enter the film, because those are usually the ones that are much less important than actually the big ones that don't charge anything.
Yeah. Well, it's like if you don't show your work, no one's ever going to see it.
Exactly.
And even and even if it's bad, well, maybe if it's bad, you should keep it back. But, you know, at least experiment.
Yeah, I mean, I feel it's not so much the exposure, actually, because if you think about it in a film festival, it's cool to see your stuff on the big screen, of course.
Sure.
But it's the great thing about it is talking to the audience and getting feedback on the stuff, because you do get that on the internet, but you get huge audiences there. But I'm not sure if the opinions of the people are that honest all the time. You
know,
people usually tend to say, it's great if they think it's great, but they tend to say nothing if they don't like it.
Well, that's the way we've been trained. That's the way we're raised. your mama always said, never say anything unless you have something nice to say.
I don't know. That's for sure.
I know. Well, see, and that's the problem is you need to have good criticism.
Exactly.
Constructive criticism so that you can grow as an artist. So,
and it doesn't mean that somebody is, you know, just mean or something. It's just being stating their honest opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, I also had a quite successful DSLR film. Actually, my first one was, because I was quite lucky to be, I think, the first filmmaker to use the 550D because a friend of mine who is working for an IT magazine, he got it a week or 2 weeks early, and I shot this film February with it. I don't know.
I saw that. That's a beautiful film.
Oh, thank you. And it was also quite a success. I mean, I just counted yesterday just because I was interested in it. I just looked at it again for the first time after, I don't know, 1.5 or 2 months, because I shot it 3.5 months ago.
Yeah, it's
and
pushing.
I realized it has 135,000 views, which is insane. Yeah. That's mainly because of the fact that it's with this new camera, I guess. But it's really crazy that I couldn't have thought of that before. I mean, before these DSLR cameras, I think even if I shot the same thing with the same looks on a normal camera with a 35mm adapter, of course, not that many people would have been interested in it, because they would think from the start, I could never afford to buy something like that. So that's a difference.
Yeah. there was a film that I found interesting that you did, because I've not ever done this, stop motion. You have the stop motion commercial there. That was, that was fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That was actually not that much work. I mean,
well, I like the behind the scenes on that. That was really cool. Yeah.
I had the best job. If you've seen that, you know, I'm just behind the camera.
Yeah.
And the other guys are just setting up the set and changing every tiny little bit of the set to make the stop motion work. And I'm just sitting there and taking my stills.
Yeah. Sebastian, if people want to find out more about you, where can they find you on the web?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, and my username is really, really difficult to spell, but I will do it. It's W-I-E-G-A-E-R-T-N-E-R, and there you will find my Twitter account, and there you can see when I post some links to my Vimeo account and to my weblog, and you can find my weblog under WeGardnerFilms.com.
Thank you. And you, Nino?
My weblog is under ninofilm.net/blog. That's the blog and the normal website with lots of older works and contact details is ninofilm.net.
Okay, thank you. Well, guys, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.